Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from a state lawmaker who's sponsoring human trafficking legislation in Wisconsin.
First, we hear these days a lot about the health benefits of exercise, and our next guest says we might be surprised at just how extensive those benefits are. He says there's an exercise prescription that can prevent, improve, or solve a wide variety of health concerns.
Dr. Jordan Metzel joins us now. He's sports medicine physician at New York City's Hospital for Special Surgery. His new book is The Exercise Cure, a doctor's all-natural, no-pill prescription for better health and longer life. Dr. Metzel, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you guys.
Well, you start the book by talking about exercise as a kind of miracle drug with proven benefits for about a zillion different conditions. In general, why is exercise so good for us?
Well, Rob, the idea of the book was I'm a sports medicine doctor in New York, and I take care of all kinds of patients of all ages who want to move and be active. I'm also a big athlete myself. I'm a big runner. I've done now 31 marathons and a bunch of triathlons, and my idea of this book was basically to combine my perspective as a doctor and my perspective as an athlete to really give the information about the amazing benefits of the drug called exercise. And when you first hear that, you might think, well, you know, I know exercise is good for me, and I knew that too. But I think my idea was to basically look at the actual science of the drug of exercise, start at the brain, and basically go down the body and lay out the case for exercise really instead of drugs for the treatment of common problems, things like depression, anxiety, sleep problems, arthritis, osteoporosis, and really a number of the common afflictions that people have. And not to say you don't need your doctor, you definitely do, but what is the role for exercise, and then how can you, as somebody listening in Wisconsin, set up an exercise program for yourself to take that medicine for yourself?
Well, and if you had a medicine that had the research that exercise has and has the benefits and the limited or no side effects or negative side effects, this would be a huge seller. So why is exercise such a hard sell to people like me?
Well, I hope it's not. I want people to exercise every day. And so I really laid out this case with that exact concept. The idea, in fact, I start the book with a kind of a fictitious doctor's appointment where you walk into the doctor's office and the doctor sits down in front of you and says, hey, listen, I have this drug and it will kind of give you these benefits starting with the brain and going all the way down the body. And all you have to do is take this drug for 150 minutes a week, 30 minutes a day. And if you do that, the health benefits are just so tremendous. And so I think everybody knows exercise is good for you. The idea of this book was to basically explain to people how it's good for you specifically and then how you can take it for yourself.
Well, let's get into some of how it's good for us. On a broad level first, longevity. How do we live longer because of exercise?
You know, so I think the most compelling piece I have here is a study that I referenced from the CDC published in 2000 looking at all-cause morbidity. And what that means is, you know, what are the reasons people get sick and what are the reasons people die? And in that study, more than 50% of the cause of – people think I have bad genetics, but in fact, more than 50% of the cause of sickness and death was related to environmental factors, things you do, your diet, your exercise. So more than half of that, you know, is related to that. So when it comes to longevity, what I tell my patients and what I say in the book as well is that you will live a longer and, most importantly, healthier life if you exercise. And one thing I like to reference is that men, on average, will live about 3 hours longer per 1 hour of exercise. That's moderate exercise. And about 5 hours longer per hour of intense exercise. And women about 7 hours longer and 11 hours longer, respectively. So it's not only is it, it's kind of good for you, it actually makes you live longer and live a healthier and less expensive medically life.
Even if we don't run marathons and triathlons like you do.
In fact, it's not for people like me. This book is actually for people like you. I want you to figure out, all right, I heard this guy, it sounds like a good idea. How do I do that? And I have patients in their 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, how do you do that? And how do you set up a program that you can do? I mean, it's probably negative 37 degrees in Wisconsin right now. How do you do that indoors? How do you build this into your life? You know, what are some of the keys to doing that and doing it effectively? And I think that's where I'm coming from on this.
Well, let's run with that point. Later, I want to get into some specific conditions, but the idea of integrating it into our daily lives. One thing that I thought was neat about your approach was the approach you call NEAT. Tell us about that.
That's a great lead-in. So what I do in this, so the first half of the book, I really designed to talk about the body by systems. So things like your brain, your heart, your lungs, and, you know, what's the scientific evidence for exercise as medicine. The second half is all about how to set up a fitness program. And I break that down into really three levels, what I call bronze, silver, and gold. So in my bronze program, that's maybe somebody who is listening who doesn't do anything and thinks, all right, I know I should do something and I really don't do anything. What can I do? And so for them, I talk about increasing their NEAT profile. And NEAT is an acronym for non-exercise active thermogenesis, or just building in things that burn calories into their everyday life. So things like, you know, walking or parking. If you're in Wisconsin, and I know there's a lot of driving, you can park further away from where you're going, or ride your bike to work if you can, or walk to work if you can. Just build in activity. You know, we see a lot of people, like, they drive to the gym to exercise and then take the elevator at the gym. You know, things to just burn calories every day. And so what's called raising your NEAT profile, I think, makes a big difference. And, again, I recognize I'm an outlier. I'm the, you know, the stuff I do is most people don't do that. I want people who don't do anything to get moving because, A, it'll make them healthier. B, it'll make them a lot happier. And C, I think from a financial point of view, you know, we spend $2.7 trillion, about 17% of our GDP, which is more than the GDP of most countries on healthcare, yet we're ranked number 28 in life expectancy. So we have a lot to do in terms of trying to get people to, you know, to cost less money and to be healthier. And I think exercise is the safest, cheapest, and certainly the most effective way to do that.
All right. So we've built those little ways. We park further away. We take the steps instead of the elevator. Now we want to do some real exercise. What are the keys to picking our first exercise program and, here's the big part, continuing to do it?
Yes, I mean, I think when you get through the bronze, then I think you get to the silver. And the silver, I think you start talking about, you know, what are some of the exercise maneuvers you can do that will, you know, kind of be work into your daily life. So I talk a lot about things like strengthening and working on your kinetic chain. That's how all the muscles in your body, tip to toe, are interrelated. And also, I have a whole illustration series of getting on what's called a foam roller, which is a way to loosen up your muscles, which I love. It's a great way to build flexibility. And those two things together can take a lot of pressure off of the joints. So if you have like an achy back or an achy knee or an achy shoulder, working on your kinetic chain can make a very, very big difference.
I want to take a look at a couple of conditions now just to get a taste of particular exercises and the benefits that we might get from them. Let's start with the obvious: weight loss.
Yeah, so, you know, I think we have this whole weight loss industry in the United States. You know, take this drug. And obviously weight loss is an easy thing to say. For people who are overweight, it's a really challenging thing to do, and so I certainly respect that. But, you know, when I think about burning calories, you know, it's certainly the safest way to lose weight and probably one of the more effective ways to keep that weight off. So, you know, what I'm asking for are things like lifestyle changes, not only increasing the number of steps. I'm a big fan of people starting to use, in fact, I'd love to hear from some of your listeners who might be using some of the newer digital pedometers, some of the new tracking devices that have technology so you can not only track the number of steps, but you can compare yourself into a community of people who are doing that, which I have found to be really effective for my patients and for people here in terms of not only doing it, but doing it in a virtual community. You know, weight loss, obviously, the more you move, the more calories you burn. I do spend some time at the end of the book talking about nutrition as part of weight loss as well. And I think, Rob, that's an important piece just because obviously what you put in makes a difference. You know, my general feeling is that, you know, if it doesn't expire until 2020, it's probably not a good idea. But other than that, you know, shopping, obviously, the perimeter of the supermarket and getting things that you see in nature, I think, is obviously the best.
All right, let's get a little more particular here. We hear a lot about a diabetes almost crisis in this country. How can our exercise help prevent or ameliorate diabetes?
So, Rob, I mean, you might be surprised to know that actually about 60% of healthcare costs in the United States, people think it's the old people that are costing us money. 60 plus percent of the healthcare costs are going to the treatment of overweight, obesity, and the related complications. You know, we have this huge obesity epidemic in the United States, and it's costing us, you know, huge amounts of money, not only now for our kids and for our kids' kids. So problems like high blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, these are very effectively treated with exercise. And I'm not saying that if you have diabetes, you won't need your insulin if you need insulin. But what I'm saying is that if you put exercise as your first-line drug, you'll need less insulin, for example. So this is a very effective drug. I want people to learn how to take it.
We're talking with Dr. Jordan Metzl. The drug is exercise. He's a sports medicine physician. His new book is The Exercise Cure.
And you can join in. Do you have a question about what kind of exercise is right for you, or a story about how you got going on an exercise program and how it affected your life and your health? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We pick up our conversation now with Dr. Jordan Metzl, author of The Exercise Cure. He says exercise can help prevent, improve, and solve almost any health problem.
You can join in with your questions about exercise, how to get started, what to do, or your experience with getting health benefits from exercise. Call in at 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org. We'll go right to the phones. We've got Lisa with us in Heartland. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I have been working on a couch to 5K type program, and I'm just curious to hear what the doctor thinks about those sorts of programs and their effectiveness.
Hey, Lisa. Nice to talk to you. So, you know, I love goal setting. And so one of the first things I talk about in people setting up an exercise program in the whole second half of the book is talking about, you know, picking a goal. And so the idea of a couch to 5K is people who are just basically sitting on the couch and then doing a 5K as a goal, and I think it's a great goal, and I think the reason it's a great goal is that 5K is about, you know, 3.1 miles, and so it's something that, you know, many people can do as a jog or as a walk or as a walk-jog. I love goal setting, and I tell all my patients that too, by the way. You need a goal. Just doing this because you know it's good for you, it doesn't work so well. So a goal is terrific, and some of the keys for people who are just setting up like a first-time program is, you know, you need to go from that bronze stage I talk about to the silver stage. And so when you get into the silver, things like doing some strength training, getting on a foam roller, loosening up your muscles, all those things will help a lot. But I love the goal setting, and I love, you know, doing that. And if you can do it, I don't know, Lisa, if you're doing it as part of a community, but I think that's even better.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Lisa, and good luck getting up to that 5K. We've got Jackie with us now in Milwaukee. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I have a puzzle for your guest. I am a 58-year-old postmenopausal breast cancer survivor, and this past year I did a medically supervised 14-week training for a triathlon.
Wow.
My BMI is 38. I completed the triathlon. All my numbers came down, my blood pressure, my blood sugar, everything. But I only lost 5 pounds. So tell me what I did not do correctly.
Well, thanks for the call, Jackie. Dr. Metzl?
Jackie, well, first of all, you know, good for you for doing it. You know, my first comment is that exercise works differently for different people, and, you know, part of this is ramping up your metabolic rate, so kind of getting your metabolism, which is how you burn calories, and getting that to ramp up and start burning calories is hugely important. Now, it may be that as you started doing this goal and started doing your triathlon training, that the weight you the actual number on the scale doesn't reflect what happened to your body. It's quite possible that you lost quite a lot of fat weight and you built some muscle weight, which comes out as the same number on the scale, but is actually quite a lot healthier for you for a number of reasons, primarily because there's an important glycoprotein, which you may not have thought about, called interleukin-6. And interleukin-6 controls much of what happens in the inflammatory cascade in the body. Interleukin-6 is made both by muscle and by fat. When it's made by muscle, it has profound anti-inflammatory properties. When it's made by fat, it's kind of a pro-inflammatory agent. It makes things that are inflamed become chronically inflamed. And so by building more muscle in your body, you're basically building in a natural anti-inflammatory, which has ramifications for all kinds of problems, including, most importantly, the rate of recurrent breast cancer is basically less than 50% less in people who exercise more than 5 times a week. So for your particular medical history, doing what you did is so hugely beneficial that I'm not worried at all about the number on the scale. I'm really proud of you for doing that, and I think it's a great thing you did.
I always wonder that. I mean, obviously this is a win here. Do we get too worried about the number on the scale and not about all the other obvious benefits that she got out of that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that people only worry about the number sometimes. And, you know, something I try and do is to explain that, you know, the number is the number. I care more about, you know, the general health and the health part of that. And it's an important question, Rob, also, just because, you know, if you look at any women's magazine in the airport, you know, you have these kind of airbrushed models who give you what the idealized body type might look like. You know, I care more about what you're doing than what you look like. And that's why I think it's such an important message.
Thanks for sharing your story, Jackie, and good luck to you. Pat in Grafton is on the line now. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi. There are parts of the world where what this doctor is doing is very commonplace among family practice doctor, you know, general practitioner. I have friends and relatives in Italy who this is their prescription for mildly elevated cholesterol levels or, you know, mildly elevated blood pressure levels. A friend of my mother's is 79 years old, has a genetic tendency towards high cholesterol, and her prescription is to walk half a day, and that's what's, you know, keeping her cholesterol level at bay. You know, it's very common for doctors to prescribe 30 minutes of walking five times a week, or, you know, 30 minutes on a stationary bike four times a week, you know, before reaching for a prescription pad and writing up a pill.
Pat, thanks for sharing that. Dr. Metzl, first of all, exercise versus cholesterol.
So, Pat, thanks for that call. You know, my first comment is that, you know, there was a big study published in October in the British Journal of Medicine that looked, among other things, is what, you know, with what frequency do doctors talk about exercise with their patients? And unfortunately, it was less than a third. So in the U.S., our doctors, you know, aren't necessarily doing a great job across the board at talking about exercise. And in many medical schools, you hear nothing about this going through medical school, and it's not really taught. And so I think the focus of what we do is very much determined by our system, which tends to be very much incentivized financially to treat disease instead of prevent illness. So, you know, the more things, the more drugs people take, the more procedures people have done to them, you know, the more the system unfortunately benefits from that. And so, you know, the focus of what I'm really trying to push is to try and stem the financial, you know, what I think to be a very bloated financial system by this drug. And when it comes to things like cholesterol, you know, you can definitely effectively lower your cholesterol with exercise. Great data that speaks to that point. Now, do you need a cholesterol-lowering medicine as well? You may, and if you do, you do. But what I can tell you is that if you take exercise as your primary drug, you'll need less of that medicine, and hopefully you won't need it at all.
Back to the phones now with Scott in Madison. Hi there, Scott.
Hey there, Doc. You know, one of my favorite quotes that I ever heard, and this has really changed my lifestyle, and it's really changed, you know, my whole body image the last couple of years, is you can't outrun a fork. And I guess I'm interested in your perspective on, you know, the fact that if you take somebody over a 30-year period and they eat 450 calories more a day, so maybe the difference of, you know, 1,900 to like 2,350, that, and which is, you know, just simply a candy bar and a can of Coke, that over a 30-year period, that's the difference between somebody being fit and somebody being obese. And I guess I'm curious on your perspective of that 450 calories, is that easier controlled through diet, or is that easier controlled through burning 450 calories a day through exercise?
Yeah, I mean, I guess now we kind of get into a philosophical, it's a great question. And my philosophy, at least at this point, is do more. I'm not a great, I mean, I certainly have a lot of nutritional information, and nutrition is obviously part of the equation. And, you know, depending on what time you have available and motivation and et cetera, you know, that the answer is either will work. But given the choice, I'm a much bigger fan of burning more calories, if possible. And I have a bunch of different ways, not only in this book, but if I can mention, I have a free workout online. If you just put in my name, Jordan Metzl, and the word iron strength, you'll get streamed to a free boot camp video you can do on your iPhone or iPad or computer at home. It's called the Iron Strength Workout, and it's a great way to start working on some kinetic chain strengthening for those of you who are out there trying to, you know, walk or run or do whatever sport and you need more muscle. It's a great way to learn how to do that online, and it's free, and I hope that helps But I think that, you know, the more calories you can burn, the better. If you're still putting on weight, then you can do some caloric restriction as well.
And you make the case for exercise because it's not just the calorie burning, it's not just the weight loss, but the other associated benefits you've been talking about here.
That's the, you know, I need 150 minutes a week for these benefits to kick in, and that's your prescription.
Speaking of time, we've got an email from Mandy. She writes, I read an article that stated just exercising for 30 to 60 minutes a day doesn't decrease the risk for long-term disease. Rather, the gist is you have to move 5 to 10 minutes every hour. Can you clarify which is better, moving every hour or having that dedicated time of exercise?
That's a good question, Mandy. I mean, I think we, you know, both are helpful. So I think when it comes to things like many of the common diseases, heart disease, et cetera, high blood pressure, you know, things like increasing your NEAT profile at work make a big difference. And so in my office, my staff gets up every 60 to 90 minutes and walks around. You know, sometimes does a couple jumping jacks, a couple squats in the office. I think sitting in one place for a long time, you know, one thing that I like to say, which I think is true, is that, you know, we've essentially done, in New York City, we've almost done away with smoking, and many places around the country with smoking laws. We're getting rid of smoking. But when you look at what inactivity does to people, you know, the chronic diseases, particularly high blood pressure, cholesterol, I think it's fair to say that, you know, sitting is the new smoking, and that I want you to get up and move. And if you can do that frequently during the day, you know, set a little alarm or once an hour, just get up, move around. If you're not in a job where you can do that, that's certainly helpful in terms of warding off some of these chronic diseases. But the answer to Mandy's question is I think both are helpful. We just care you get the number in.
Dr. Metzl, thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
That's Dr. Jordan Metzl. His new book is The Exercise Cure, a doctor's all-natural, no-pill prescription for better health and longer life.
Coming up, a state lawmaker joins us to talk about a new effort to strengthen Wisconsin's human trafficking laws. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
January is Human Trafficking Awareness Month, and the Wisconsin State Legislature is currently circulating a new bill addressing the issue here in Wisconsin. The bill had 20 co-sponsors by yesterday afternoon.
The bill was authored by Republican Representative Amy Loudenbeck and Senator Jerry Petruski, with backing from Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen.
The bill comes after a Department of Justice study last year that showed law enforcement agencies in Wisconsin routinely deal with human trafficking. Here with us to talk about the new bill is co-author Representative Amy Loudenbeck of Clinton. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Amy, why is this the right time to introduce this bill?
Well, this will be the third human trafficking proposal that the legislature has contemplated since the mid-2000s. The first bill in 2007 was identifying it as an issue and creating some definitions and legal mechanisms. Last year, we provided some additional supports for law enforcement. And this bill, this package of bills, the time is right because it's building on what we've done in the past, but it's really getting down to some of the issues in particular that victim advocates have been concerned about, where I think we've identified the problem, we've created, we have good systems in place for dealing with it, and now we're adding even more resources and strength to the current law that we have.
Can you give us a sense of just how widespread the problem of human trafficking is in Wisconsin?
Well, I think we can look back to one of the incidents this summer where 10 children in Wisconsin were rescued from child trafficking networks, and there was a nationwide FBI investigation going on in Wisconsin, and that is something that I think surprised a lot of people. One of the reports that I referenced last session on the bill that I worked on, it was called Hidden in Plain Sight, because oftentimes if it's child trafficking, if it's sex trafficking, labor trafficking, it's going on around us, but we're not aware of the psychological patterns that are going on in another, you know, outside of what we see in public. And this is really bringing to light some of the really egregious and horrific things that are happening in Wisconsin, and recognizing it's not just a rural issue or an urban issue. It exists around us. We just haven't been looking for it.
What new strategies for dealing with human trafficking and its victims does the new bill suggest?
One of the strengthening aspects that have been added is to apply some of the racketeering and forfeiture provisions that exist in a drug dealer or someone is going to have some financial downside when they're facing a conviction. And so things like vehicle forfeiture and other financial hardships are going to be put on these traffickers. And so those financial penalties did not exist under current law because, again, with the definitions, we had to add sex trafficking and add that to the existing process. So some financial hardships for the traffickers, and then there's some significant improvements in the way that the legal system looks at victims of trafficking, particularly minors engaged in sex trafficking, that, you know, these young people are victims. They need access to services. They should not be treated like criminals. Really important differences in the way that we look at the victim versus and the pattern of abuse and recognize it for what it is.
And there's a specific provision for individuals who've been charged with prostitution too, right?
Yes, there is a provision in the bill that would allow someone to come forward later and provide evidence that showed that indeed that they should not have been convicted of prostitution, that they should have their conviction vacated or expunged, and to make their case and lay out the facts of why they didn't disclose at the time that they were a victim of human trafficking. And it could have been because their trafficker was a boyfriend or a family member and they were afraid, and so they just took the prostitution charge and then, you know, later maybe got their life together and realized, you know, I need vindication, or this is preventing me from getting employment, and I shouldn't have this on my record. I was a victim. I wasn't a criminal. And so this creates a process for them to go through the legal system and possibly get that off of their record.
Who do you expect to be most affected by these changes that are being made in the bill?
I think that over the long term, law enforcement and prosecutors that have come forward, that because this is an evolving kind of understanding in statute, that the prosecutors will probably have a lot more cases that they can actually bring through and prosecute. There's some other definitions and some other things that are inside of the bill that are going to make it easier for prosecutors to say, you know, I know what's going on. There's a pattern of abuse. This is trafficking, but I'm having a really hard time proving it. And this bill is going to make it so that they can put the bad guys away, because it really is something that it's frustrating for them because they see these victims, and unfortunately sometimes we can't help them.
Now, you referenced that the last human trafficking law passed here in Wisconsin in 2007. Do you think there's kind of been this sense that, yeah, human trafficking is a big problem, but it's a big problem somewhere else, you know, like on the coast, maybe in California, Nevada, the East Coast, but maybe something recently, you mentioned the case this summer, it's been hitting home that this is a problem right here in Wisconsin?
Well, unfortunately, the traffickers, they prey on vulnerable populations. So if you're looking at, you know, at homeless teens or at people that are at a financial disadvantage, they're taking that situation and using coercion and using sometimes physical force or other types of power to take over, you know, someone's personal body. And when you look at the vulnerable, where there are vulnerable populations, I think in any state, it's not like international, you know, sex trafficking rings. This is somebody taking, you know, finding and targeting vulnerable people and victims. And, you know, in Wisconsin, we're generally a trusting society. And so, you know, to think that someone is, you know, they're trying to help you when they're not, it's a whole syndrome of abuse, of psychological abuse. Again, something that there are vulnerable populations here and people are trusting. So it's definitely happening.
Do you have any idea about how Wisconsin stacks up in terms of volume of human trafficking as compared to other states?
That's not something I'm comfortable quantifying. Again, I think that we're going to see with these bills, we're going to see more prosecutions coming out. But as far as where it exists and the number of incidents, I don't have a whole lot of comparisons. There are groups that compare Wisconsin to other states as far as how we rank in our efforts to combat human trafficking, and we're moving up the ranks in that regard. But we're still kind of in the middle.
Have you personally met any of the victims? Is this at all personal for you?
No, it is not. Although there are going to be, it's my understanding that we are probably going to have some folks testifying this time around that are victims. Someone that, especially in the case of the prosecution, the vacation of the prosecution, that we're going to have someone that will share their story and what happened.
Now, as of yesterday, this bill was just introduced, and you had 20 co-sponsors already. Were you surprised at the amount of support early on?
I was very pleased. Strong bipartisan support, and I think part of it is, you know, having the Attorney General, who is known for. I mean, we've spent a lot of time on the drafting and making sure that these ideas have been vetted and that they're good. And for me, this is the second time I've worked with him. So, you know, people in the Assembly and the Senate, you know, a lot of us voted for a proposal that was similarly authored last session. So there's that trust as far as in the issue area. But and people have also known that we were working on it, so there was some expectation that people were going to jump on. But I'm actually pleasantly surprised, and we've gotten a few more in today, and we still have about another 24 hours left, so hopefully we'll get some more.
Now, as you said, the last human trafficking bill passed in Wisconsin was in 2007, and so here we are 7 years later. Are there things in this bill that you still feel could use addressing, maybe for another bill down the road?
There's always remaining. Actually, there was 2007, there was 2011, and then there's this one. So this will be the third. But there will continue to be recommendations and policy suggestions that come from advocacy groups. I mean, we're trying to choose things that we know we can implement and we can make work within existing laws. Some states, Minnesota has what's kind of considered the gold standard. It's the Safe Harbor Act, where it really gets all of the different service agencies, corrections, children and families in our case, and other, the CPS, to work together with law enforcement to, again, provide the services to the victims. We don't have a comprehensive approach to this right now. And so, but it's something that would require a lot of agency cooperation that obviously would require some funding. So I see that as something that once we have the enforcement framework, that we can work more on the support services for victims.
So that might be down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of down the road, when can we expect this bill to go to the legislature for a vote?
I would hope that with something that we can be looking at in committee during the later part of January, and hopefully looking at floor votes in February. Would be very, very exciting, I think, because we are running out of time in the session here.
Well, Representative Loudenbeck, thank you so much for joining us and for talking about this today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Representative Amy Loudenbeck. She co-authored a new human trafficking bill in the state legislature. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Time now for Curious Wisconsin. This week we head to Eagle River to find out about a castle made of ice.
It's an annual tradition in the town dating back to the early 20th century. Built by local volunteer firefighters, it brings visitors from all over the state and beyond.
We've got Jim Bonson with us now. He's the deputy fire chief at the Eagle River Fire Department. He helped build this year's castle. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hi, everybody.
Well, first of all, can you tell us a little bit about this year's ice castle?
Well, this year's ice castle is the first one we've been able to do for the last 3 years due to the problem with the ice thickness the last two, but this year the ice was up around 15.5 inches, and so it worked out fine. We love doing it between the holidays. We're able to get more people to help us out, and it makes the project go a lot quicker.
Can you describe it for us? Tell us what it looks like and maybe how big it is.
Well, the ice castle is approximately, the middle tower is roughly around 25 feet high.
Wow.
We've got two thrones on it this year, one on the north side, one on the south side for picture opportunities. And it's roughly probably around 25 by 30 feet in diameter.
Do they keep getting bigger and bigger over time?
Well, we're limited to the space where we can build it. And probably it's good that it doesn't get bigger and bigger all the time. But, you know, the space that we have able to build it in Eagle River limits us, and sometimes the designs that we can do, just because it's we got a snowmobile trail that is one side, parking on the other side, so we get sort of limited with this location. and this is the only location left, really, to build the ice castle where everybody can really get a view of it.
So how do you build it? Do you drop a plan and then you carve blocks of ice, or is it some newfangled way?
Well, actually, we go back to the days when they actually harvested ice. When ice harvesting was a big business in northern Wisconsin, and they were sending ice down to the Milwaukee and Chicago metro areas by rail. And the ice castle started in 1933, was the first year that they ever had one. The owner of the ice and coal was Chuck Hankey, who happened to be at the same time the fire chief here in Egg River, but there was no association between the fire department and the ice castle then. So actually, we're using the same tools, the same saws that they use when they harvest ice. And the first day of the progress is to score the ice, and we score the ice 10 inches by 20 inches, and approximately we try to get as deep as we can, 10 to 12 inches, without going through the ice, as we do not want the water to come up or we score it and refreeze it. The second day is the day that we take the ice out of Silver Lake. And this year we pulled 2,400 blocks out. It was about a 12-hour process to get all the ice out of the lake.
Wow.
And then on Saturday we have a shaver that we made so we can get all the ice so it's the same thickness, because that really speeds up the construction process. And then from that point, it's like just laying cement blocks, except we're using ice.
I don't know how much a 10-by-20 block of ice would weigh. I've never picked up that chunk of ice. How heavy are these?
Well, with my age, they get heavier every year. They go about 80, 85 pounds with the depth that we had this year. Like I said, the ice was 15.5 inches, and we shaved off 1.5 inches, so we're dealing with 14-inch thick ice blocks. And they roughly, you know, right around 80 pounds is what they're going to come out to. And we've got a system where we don't have to lift a lot of the ice, but there are some blocks that you still have to lift. And but we try to just slide ice the most that we can. We use the forklifts to help us get the ice up to each core so we can just slide it off the pallet onto the wall so we don't have to lift a lot of ice.
Pretty amazing. You don't use a chainsaw or anything. You score the ice using these old saws. This is a labor of love that you do.
Well, it's a tradition. We still have the one-man ice saws. We cut islands of 10 blocks at a time, float it down a channel to conveyor, and then we break the ice apart as it goes up the conveyor. So that's the second day is where it's labor-intensive as far as the sawing part goes. I try to get our younger bodies under there. I need exercise, but I don't need that kind of exercise anymore. So
at that stage, you've got the ice blocked and cut and ready to build. How long does it take to build the actual castle then?
It will run 2 to 3 days, actually, to get the whole structure up. And then we take a couple days to put some frills on it. We, you know, have special, we call them duhas, and we put on the corners to dress it up, and then we make these thrones where people can sit and take pictures. In Egg River, the ice castle is probably the most photographed thing that we have when we're able to construct it.
It seems like for a long time the volunteer fire department has been in charge of building the ice castle. Is it a fun event that everybody looks forward to, or do you go, oh no, it's ice castle time again?
Well, the fire department's been doing it actually since 1987. And the fire chief then, his name was Jack Thomas, and he happens to be the grandson of Charles Hankey. So that's where we were able to inherit all the tools. And he has designed all the ice castles since 1987. And he actually uses, like, Lego blocks to lay out a design, then transfers that over the graph paper, and then figures out approximately how many ice blocks we're going to need. So.
And does he come and act as the foreman and make sure you're getting his design right?
Yeah, he does it all the time since we've been doing it. And he's 77 now, and he's still active with it. I've been active with the ice castle since 1978. And then it ceased for a while, and that's when the community approached the fire department and see if we'd pick the project back up again because it's something that the community really loves. Our visitors that come here, the tourists, snowmobilers, they just get fascinated by it, you know, just this structure of ice. And so it's been a tradition. Those of us that do a lot of work on it, we do like doing it. But yeah, there are times when it's like, as you get older, at least the older I get, is another year of doing the ice cap.
I bet the town loves it, though. How long does it usually stay up before it starts to melt?
It'll stay up probably with the cold temperatures we've inherited this year. It should be up till almost the end of February.
Does it melt away, or does it eventually break the ice underneath it and kind of go real dramatically?
It's more of a melt than maybe a evaporation with the wind. Once it starts getting into where the cracks are, then the wind really starts to eat it away. And so we keep it up until it gets to a point where you feel that it's no longer safe to keep up, and then we'll take a backhoe in there and knock it down.
You don't want tourists coming in and wandering in just as it's getting ready to fall on them.
Right.
Makes sense.
You know, it all varies on weather. If we get into a real long, warm spell, that will season the longevity of the ice castle.
Now, if somebody's listening and they're inspired by this whole ice castle building thing, do you accept volunteers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the fire department does, you know, we got quite a few of our members that are there daily. 20 to 24 of our members are there daily, but it takes more people than just that to do everything. And so we welcome volunteers. The local businesses and contractors, they come forward, you know, supplying either meals or hot coffee, hot chocolate. A lot of the equipment that we need, as far as like the forklifts and that, propane gas and run the forklifts, that all gets donated. So it is really a community project and something the community is really proud of.
Jim, you've got two thrones there. Is there an ice castle king and or queen?
Nope. But we've had, in the past, we've had one marriage taking place.
All right.
So, and a couple of our governors have been up here with picture ops in front of the ice castle.
What would you say it's meant to the people of Eagle River over the years?
Well, since 1933, we keep doing it. And when it gets a few years where you don't have it due to the weather or whatever, people start talking about it again. And once it goes back up, it's just, you know, the compliments that we firefighters receive, it makes all the work well worth it.
Jim, thanks so much for joining us today. It's a lot of fun.
Sure. And make sure, you know, if you've never seen an ice castle, come to Eagle River. And then we've got the vintage races starting this weekend. Then the Snowmobile Derby is next weekend. There's a lot of activity happening up in northern Wisconsin.
Jim Bonson is the deputy fire chief of the Eagle River Fire Department. We've got a picture of the ice castle now. We've got an old one, I think, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Give you an idea of what they look like.